Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to session number 164, titled From Exclusion to Acceptance, the Task of God's People and All Dispensations. If you were expecting a topic other than that, you're in the wrong room, you'll have to go somewhere else, where you could stay and listen to this. As usual, we ask you that you make sure that your cell phones are turned off and that everybody be respectful and attentive. Sunstone tries very hard to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so please keep that in mind, particularly when engaging in questions and answers. If you can't do that, there will be a Danite coming into the room at the beginning of the question and answer period and will escort you out. The session is being recorded. We do not have a floor microphone, so Lisa has agreed to, you can either come up and use one of these mics if you like, or if you're more comfortable staying in your seat, ask your question. Lisa will restate it to make sure that it gets recorded and then give you her interpretation or answer to your question. A couple of other pieces of information I think you've already heard. Sunstone is offering a really good bargain. If you want to subscribe to the magazine, you can get 7 issues for the price of 6. They're also having Skullcandy official headphones on sale. And also you can get a copy of this session recorded after the session concludes. So once again, don't be a jerk, and if you are, the Danite will remove you. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep that time frame in mind so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. Chosen people have always excluded groups distinctly different from the then current perspectives of who is acceptable to God. The physically imperfect during the time of the Second Temple, non-Jews during both Old and New Testament times, a prejudice maintained by Christ followers until Peter's vision, people who have been divorced, people who have used any form of birth control, and up until 40 years ago, people with any black ancestry. This presentation focuses on our understanding of God and what kind of people God views as profane has developed over time. How might it still be changing today? Lisa Hansen is a licensed marriage and family therapist in private practice, co-editor of Why I Don't Hide My Freckles Anymore, and founder and former director of Utah County Men's Voices. And I have to say before I sit down that my daughter won the Santa Barbara, California Freckle Contest 2 straight years in a row. So without any further ado, Lisa Hansen.
Congratulations to your daughter. And thank you to all those who were my heroes getting the technology to work. Thank you very much. I'm really glad that you're here. I hope you enjoy what I have to share. In my first semester as a grad student therapist, I was assigned to see a couple who had been married in the temple about a year. They were a quiet couple and were tuned into each other in ways other couples might envy. Although neither of them ever used the word transgender, the husband explained he had always believed himself to be female, being averse to his male anatomy from his earliest memories. He persistently yearned to be rid of the physical features that defined him as male, but had decided to keep them because his wife liked them and it felt like the right gift to give her for the present. This couple came to me for therapy because they worried about the future. Given these feelings, could they stay married? They certainly both wanted to stay married. Would these feelings resolve and go away? If not, could their children be emotionally healthy? Could they remain close to the church as they both hoped to do? If the husband followed his desire to wear women's clothing, would their bishop question the husband's mental health? Would he face church discipline? How would their families react? This couple's distress over these questions kept them coming to therapy for nearly a year. It was clear to me there was no mental illness in this couple, yet they still experienced deep distress about church and family issues surrounding the husband's sense of himself as a woman. Although this couple is easy for me to remember, there have been so many other gender and sexual minority clients since in Utah Valley for me that it's hard now to remember my first gay client, my first lesbian client couple, my first gay parent wrestling with whether leaving would cause more pain or finally bring relief to the wife and children he loved. What I do remember about working with gender and sexual minorities is, if they were Mormon, their first and deepest emotional crisis generally revolved around the question, what is my future, and what if I lose my church and my family? How will I survive? This question often came from people who had never broken the law of chastity. They still often felt a strong sense that experiencing gender dysphoria or same-sex attraction destined them for a life outside of the mainstream of Mormon experience, both in the present and in the eternal sense. After speaking with hundreds of Mormons dealing with this distress and with dozens of other therapists who also see SSA or LGBTQ clients, I feel safe in saying that for most LDS people in the same-sex attracted or LGBT spectrum, this potential loss of church and family, both now and in eternity, is a legitimate fear for them. It's impossible, perhaps, to grow up as a Mormon and not hear the strong message that everything about living the gospel revolves around your future in a heterosexual family. And because Mormons believe we understand the way families are organized eternally in God's plan, the gospel does not currently have room, either presently or in eternity, for misgendered bodies or for lesbian and gay parented families. Any gray area of accepting queer couples or families in our communities has been substantially eliminated. In most any gospel doctrine class or Relief Society lesson, someone will likely reiterate a version of this point. Revelation has made clear there is only one kind of romantic or sexual relationship acceptable to God, and that is between a man and a woman. For those who do not fit the straight cisgender model, believing that the gospel is as true for them as it is for straight people may never come. This experience, however devastating, is not unique to our time. In the name of God, the gospel has always included prohibitions against the full participation of those who exhibit characteristics the faithful label as profane, or as being disturbingly, unacceptably unlike God. For example, during Old Testament times, does this work that way? Okay. During Old Testament times, the lame and the blind were prohibited from making offerings in the temple or from coming anywhere near the temple. The Levitical code given to Aaron and his descendants specifically denies anyone who is blemished from performing offerings in the temple. In Leviticus, the Lord speaks to Moses and says, "Whosoever be of thy seed," actually speaking to Aaron, "in their generations that hath any blemish, let him not approach to offer the bread of God." 12 such blemishes are then enumerated: a blind man, a lame, he that hath a flat nose, or anything superfluous, or a man that is broken-footed, or broken-handed, or crook-backed, or a dwarf, or that hath a blemish in his eye, or be scurvy, or scabbed, or hath his stones broken. The prohibition was explained as necessary so that a blemished worshiper, quote, "Profane not my sanctuaries, for I, the Lord, do sanctify them." According to noted Old Testament scholar Carl Eliger, this passage suggests that ancient Israel used an older tradition which had listed these same 12 disabilities as objectionable in excluding persons from the priesthood. Thomas Hentrick notes that these 12 disabilities all have in common that they would not ipso facto prevent someone from exercising the function of a priest. But the author of the law felt the need to stress that even such mild cases, quote, would defile the holiness of the temple. Hendrick explains that the reason for this would be a perceived demonic influence to which the afflicted person owed his blemished fate. God would therefore not reside within the blemished person, and both his presence and his offering would be unacceptable in God's holy place. Klaus, wow, time is flying. I may skip over some of this. These attitudes toward disability seem foreign to us now. But at the time, physical ailments and imperfections were viewed as curses for disobedience. A person who failed to observe, to do all God's commandments and statutes could be afflicted with consumption, with a fever, with inflammation, madness, blindness, be smitten in the knees and in the legs with a sore that cannot be healed. All of this is from Deuteronomy. If a person experienced a blemish in physical health, it was seen as a character flaw, a spiritual problem, a behavior problem, an indication that the person was not worthy to participate fully in the ordinances of the chosen people of God. In the modern church, the idea of preventing people with physical disabilities, this is a lame and the blind, this is a crippled, this is Jesus healing. In the modern church, the idea of preventing people with physical disabilities from participating in temple ordinances is obsolete. Mormon temples are specifically designed at great expense to accommodate disabled persons. From parking lots to restrooms, elevators, captioning services during presentations, temple workers strive to allow persons with disabilities to engage and to participate fully in all temple ordinances, even if abled persons inconvenienced. Thank you. It's not written here. Thank you. Although we may still believe imperfect bodies are not like God, we understand the hearts and souls of the people in such bodies are just as likely as anyone else to have a close relationship with God and to offer acceptable temple service. Interestingly, there appears to have been no specific revelation to counter the Old Testament understanding of physical imperfection. In New Testament times, the people of God still believe physical imperfections resulted from sin or demonic influence. Accordingly, the New Testament Jews asked, and these were Jesus' disciples, "Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And in answer to this question, Jesus did not specifically counter or correct the exclusionary Levitical temple practices, but answered, "Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest." Jesus made clear that disability did not equal disobedience or being an enemy to God. In addition, he emphasized that God intended to do divine work through this difference. It is perhaps impossible to overstate the paradigm shift of several thousand years of certainty about disabled people representing something unlike God. Although Jesus healed many blind and lame people, making manifest the works of God through healing them, it is likely that another way God intends to make his works manifest through disabled people is by helping able-bodied people develop Christ-like qualities by understanding and serving them. The works of God are present as people engage in sacrifice and service, getting to know with a greater Christ-like love those who seem other. This is the work of God made manifest. The current LDS First Presidency Statement on Disabilities notes a great need to reduce the barriers imposed by a lack of understanding and acceptance of those who have disabilities, urging members to accept those as children of God and help them feel respected, loved, and understood, and to assist in the successful church participation of people with disabilities and the appreciation of their unique gifts, to provide meaningful opportunities for members with disabilities to serve, teach, and lead others. The statement concludes, "It is our opportunity and our responsibility to follow the example of Jesus in loving our neighbors, and that includes those with disabilities." The presence of disabled persons no longer profanes God's house. They are no longer considered enemies of God, and their participation is no longer considered blasphemy or the commission of sin. Despite our continued belief that God has a perfect body, we now understand bodies on earth are not all created perfectly, and that an imperfect body should not deny someone the opportunity to serve and participate in the temple. We have expanded our understanding of God to imagine that those who are physically whole and those who are not may be spiritual equals before God on earth. As a matter of fact, this is the church's wheelchair initiative. And we now have a song in the children's songbook, thanks to Carolyn, that invites us to walk with those who are different from us. And of course, this is at the temple. Others have also been prohibited from inclusion in our sacred spaces. In both Old and New Testament times, people who were not of the house of Israel were often particularly rejected, even when they desired to join the covenant people. The privilege of being of the house of Israel began when the Lord appeared to Abraham, making a covenant with him to make him exceedingly fruitful and a father of many nations, promising to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. Then the Lord told Abraham, "This is my covenant, which ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man among you shall be circumcised. And the uncircumcised man, child, whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant." Circumcision thereafter became a singular indicator of those who kept the covenant of God. So important was circumcision that when the children of Israel finished their 40-year march and were preparing to enter the promised land, they had to ensure first every male who had been born in the last 40 years was circumcised. Hundreds of years later, one of the punishments the Lord promised the disobedient was that they would be punished with the uncircumcised, and that Egypt, Judah, Edom, the children of Ammon and Moab, and all that are in the utmost corners, for all these nations are uncircumcised. One of the greatest blessings promised by Isaiah for the last days was that when Zion would be redeemed, there shall no more come unto thee the uncircumcised. The people of God saw this as a commandment that would last until the last days. Only those who had been circumcised in Israel were allowed access to the sanctuary and later the temple of God. Not only were these holy places to remain sacred from the uncircumcised, but the people of God were expressly prohibited from eating the Passover meal with any uncircumcised visitor. According to the words of Moses, "And when a stranger shall sojourn with thee and will keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof." And as for the temple, Ezekiel records the rebuke God gave Israel, "In that ye have brought into my sanctuary strangers, uncircumcised in flesh, to be in my sanctuary to pollute it." For the people of ancient Israel, those who were uncircumcised profaned the house of the Lord by representing something profoundly not God, such that their presence was blasphemy. God's sacred space was to be approached only by those who kept the covenant of Abraham by marking their bodies in a covenant way. As Old Testament scholar Mark Awabdi noted, we may safely conclude that any impulse toward integrating eligible foreigners into the worship of Jehovah has been subordinated to restoring and maintaining the purity of his sacred space. So strong was the sense of sacred space that when the Jews in the New Testament times saw men they believed were uncircumcised at the temple and believed Paul had brought them there, a murderous riot ensued. This is Isaac being circumcised. This is the house of Israel destroying other nations that were uncircumcised. And this is Paul at the temple being the subject of the murderous riot. "This Paul," they said, "is the man that brought Greeks into the temple and hath polluted this holy place." And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple and went about to kill him. And by the laws of blasphemy, they might have been justified, for God's law was clear. Because this event occurred after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we may tell ourselves this story shows the ignorance of people who did not understand that Christ came to fulfill the law of Moses. Yet it is important to remember that the leaders of the fledgling Christian faith may not fully have understood that circumcision would ever have been withdrawn. When Paul had earlier returned to Jerusalem, unto James and all the elders, it says, some of the elders had criticized Paul, quote, "that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles they ought not to circumcise their children." This seemed blasphemy to them, because the covenant of circumcision was thought to be a sign forever of who is acceptable to God. Jesus himself had been circumcised, and there is nothing in the New Testament that suggests that Jesus informed his followers that the requirement of circumcision would be fulfilled or done away with. This question caused dissension in the early church, with some leaders teaching, quote, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved, unquote. So the apostles and elders came together to consider this matter, which the scripture tells us resulted in much disputing. When Peter took his turn to speak, he reminded his listeners of the vision he had received some time before that made it possible for the Gentiles to hear the word of God, quote, and believe. This vision, recorded in Acts 10, had changed Peter's understanding of what God considered to be clean and unclean, what God considered to be acceptable. As Peter said to the uncircumcised Cornelius, who approached him immediately after the vision, ye know that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. But God hath showed me I should not call any man common or unclean, unquote. Although this vision had taken place earlier, it was still difficult for many early Christians to accept that even believing Gentiles could toss aside such an important covenant requirement as circumcision. Perhaps they wondered how Gentiles could ever have the same sense of sacred consecration in their own bodies as they had developed through this everyday connection as a sign of temporal consecration which God had required of every believing soul for several thousand years. For these Christians, there was likely no stronger personal connection to God than the circumcision of their covenant. It was daily evidence that they had been set apart from the world, a symbol in their most private parts that God remembered them and they remembered God. On the occasion of this meeting and the dispute, Peter reminded his brethren that the heart was more important than the circumcision. He told them that God knew the hearts of the Gentiles, and so, quote, God, who knows the heart, acknowledged the believing Gentiles by giving them the Holy Spirit, just as he did to us, and made no distinction between us and them, purifying their hearts by faith without circumcision. Now, therefore, said Peter, why do you test God by putting a yoke on the neck of those who would believe, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? Then James recommended that the brethren should not trouble those from among the Gentiles who desire to turn to God by imposing circumcision on them, but ask them only to keep a portion of the law. It seems likely that those who had been circumcised, especially those who may have elected to be circumcised as adults, in order to keep the whole law, might have especially chafed at the idea of abandoning circumcision, and that new believers might never know God in the same way they had through the sacrifices they had made to enter into the covenant. How could God find the Gentile sacrifice acceptable without it? Yet at this point, the early church leaders sent out a letter to the brethren who are of the Gentiles, quote unquote, saying, since we have heard that some who went out from us have troubled you with words unsettling your souls, saying you must be circumcised and keep the law, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden. And when the Gentiles read the letter, they rejoiced over its encouragement. In the church today, as in the Christian world generally, believers readily accept that God views uncircumcised people as acceptable, even in holy places. As members of the church, we no longer require people to be circumcised prior to entering the temple or making covenants with God. It is easy now for us to believe that it is the condition of our hearts and not the condition of our anatomy that makes the difference to God. As people of God, or as the people who are coming to know God, we have once again expanded our understanding of what kind of people, what kind of bodies are enough like God that they can approach God's holy space when their hearts are converted. Because, let me make sure I'm doing on time. Okay. Because the prohibitions against the participation of disabled and uncircumcised people occurred prior to the restoration of the gospel in our dispensation, it may be easy for us to dismiss these changes as not applying to the church now, in the fullness of times, yet we in the Mormon experience have not been exempt. Christ's words about divorce in the New Testament are clear. Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery. These are the words of Christ. Yet members... wait a minute, that's not what I wanted to say next. This is the part that I have arrows going this way now. Members of the church, our acceptance, we now accept divorce as a solution to many problems in our society, as being important, valuable, necessary. Yet our members still worry that when they divorce, they will lose church and family belonging. It is easy for us to see that not all current divorces are adulterous, nor are all remarriages adulterous, because we know the hearts of people who are divorced and remarried. We recognize that in many situations, the divorce is the spiritual, emotional, and physically healthy path, and we are happy for those who are able to remarry and create successful companionships. We have expanded our understanding of changing relationships as being acceptable to God. Divorce itself does not keep people out of the temple, nor do we any longer automatically equate it with adultery, despite the clear teaching of Christ in the New Testament. Another area in which members of the church have shifted our understanding of what is acceptable to God are our reactions to people who use birth control. In the early 19th century America, a publication on contraception by a physician earned its author an obscenity conviction with several months at hard labor. Few states had legislation on abortion, and where they did, it was usually only prohibited after quickening, usually about the 18th to 20th week of pregnancy. By the 1870s, a strong anti-abortion movement began in Catholic and Protestant circles, which resulted in an 1876 law against abortion in Utah. It was during this time we find the first real discussion of fertility control among the Mormons. Owing to universal sensibilities regarding obscenity, Mormon references to contraception were euphemistically vague. Brigham Young spoke of, quote, attempts to destroy and dry up the fountains of life. Erastus Snow spoke of taking villainous compounds to induce barrenness and unfruitfulness, and the devices of wicked men and women that resulted in apparent sterility. Parley P. Pratt found scriptural proscriptions of voluntary acts which prevent propagation. As Erastus Snow summarized, the saints do not patronize wicked devices whereby to check the multiplication of their species in open violation to the laws of God and to our first parents to multiply and replenish the earth. Husbands and wives who succumb to their fleshly lusts and secured for themselves the pleasure of self-gratification without bearing the responsibilities of maternity, those are not my words, were one and the same with those who engaged in abortion and infanticide or otherwise drying up the wellsprings of life. President John Taylor instructed bishops and stake presidents to ensure that those involved in such practices not be allowed in the temple and to sever them from the church. They shall not have a place in the church or kingdom of God, unquote. President Joseph F. Smith gave his strong response to questions about decisions to preserve the mother's health. I do not hesitate to say that prevention is wrong. It brings in its train a host of social evils. It destroys the morals of a community and nation. It creates hatred and selfishness in the hearts of men and women and perverts their natural qualities of love and service. It causes death and decay. And finally, it disregards or annuls the great commandments of God. Joseph Fielding Smith added his assertion, those who attempt to prevent their offspring from coming into the world are guilty of one of the most heinous crimes. There is no promise of eternal salvation and exaltation for such as they. Yet beginning in 1920, Mormon birth rates declined steadily. And general authorities called to serve after 1930 averaged about half as many children as their immediate predecessors. As the Mormon birth rate declined, so also did the frequency of public references by church leaders to birth control. In 1957, the Conservative American Medical Association endorsed contraception for the purpose of, quote, voluntary family limitation, unquote. And by the mid-1930s, polls indicated a majority of American women believed in the practice of birth control. In 1935, over 80% of 1,300 Mormon students at BYU felt the same way. Yet David O. McKay, while a member of the First Presidency, taught, quote, the viewpoint of the church is that the use of artificial prevention is strictly out of line, unquote. And in 1958, Bruce R. McConkie wrote, those who practice birth control, the regulation of births in a family by the employment of artificial means or contraception to prevent conception, are running counter to the foreordained plan of the Almighty. They are in rebellion against God and are guilty of gross wickedness. Informal polls now put both birth control usage among active Mormon women of childbearing age at about 90%. And the most recent policy statement clarifies such decisions are properly between husband and wife. No longer are a couple's contraceptive decisions made part of their worthiness to participate in temple ordinances. As a people, we have effectively expanded our understanding of what kind of marital behaviors are acceptable to God. I forget what I have next. Oh, this is my last slide. So it will do for the rest. The teachings of the prophets for some time after Brigham Young's presidency was that the policy of not ordaining black men to the priesthood and nor allowing any black persons in the temple had been revealed by God. Great pains were taken to help church members understand God's laws may not make sense to us, but consist of a test of our obedience, constitute a test of our obedience. In 1978, President Spencer W. Kimball received the revelation that it was time to extend priesthood and temple blessings to all races. His son, Edward Kimball, records in a BYU Studies article just how many years President Kimball searched the hearts of his people to find out if they were ready for such a change. These are some of the things that Edward has written. Spencer always responded to questions about policy and doctrine with traditional, orthodox explanations, even within his family. But it is clear that inwardly he struggled with the priesthood issue and wished the Lord would permit a change. He felt compassion toward those excluded and perhaps guilt that faithful men were banned from responsibility and blessings that he himself prized. Spencer confided his concern for giving the priesthood to all men and said he had been praying about it for 15 years. In a 1971 devotional address, he spoke of the Apostle Peter and specified that Peter announced a major policy change in the church whereby Gentiles might be accepted. Clearly, he was looking ahead. President Kimball expressed his own concerns about internal dissent should such a policy change occur. Particularly, he was worried about dissent from members in the American South and even in the Quorum of the Twelve. President Hinckley said about him, he was not the first to worry about the priesthood question, but he had the compassion to pursue it and a boldness that allowed him to act. Wary of ways in which the question had been divisive during the McKay administration, President Kimball asked the apostles to join him as colleagues in extended study and supplication. Spencer had written in a letter to his son, revelations will probably never come unless they are desired. I think few people will see revelations while lounging on the couch. I believe most revelations will come when a man is on his tiptoes, reaching as high as he can for something which he knows he needs, and then there bursts upon him the answer. And this is interesting to note as well. In 1997, someone recorded in a meeting, Elder Boyd K. Packer, pleaded with the Lord that the way be opened for those from whom the priesthood is withheld. So there was a, that doesn't include a lot of the statements that Edward Kimball said, that when his father would go to stake meetings, he would always ask the stake president, how would you feel if blacks were to hold the priesthood in your stake? He was constantly concerned with how the rank and file members of the church would feel about such a policy change. And now the Church Newsroom's essay on race and the priesthood acknowledges that the church's racial policy was likely rooted in the racist culture of the times in which the church was developing. If obeying the commandment to prohibit temple blessings to a race of people was a test from God, what kind of test was it? Was it just a test of obedience? Or like the earlier Old Testament prohibitions, was it a test of our hearts? The remarkable picture that develops as the history of the people of God is reviewed is this. God seems to be waiting for his covenant people to be ready for the next step of inclusion. Although the Jews of the Old Testament may have learned something important about God by refusing to let the lame and blind people desecrate the temple, it is possible that God was hoping their awareness of others' hearts and needs would allow them to eventually see lame and blind people differently, to see them as worthy of being included as equals. It is worth remembering that the anathema of disability was so strong for God's covenant people, it was not overcome for several thousand years. In order for such a change to have happened, this references a story I didn't tell you. King David actually records that he hated the lame and the blind, and that hate had to be reduced. It seems so natural, it hardly had to be explained in 2 Samuel. Next, the people had to move past the deeply held belief that having an imperfect body meant God was not working sufficiently within that person, or God had determined that person to be unacceptable for temple service. While we find this shift fairly easy for disability, we should not discount how difficult it was for people who were certain God had given the commandment through his prophets precisely because God had found disabled persons unacceptable. It is likely that the exclusion of Gentiles and non-circumcised people from participating in the Abrahamic covenant taught the Jews something important about God. And yet it is also likely that the Jews had to be ready to turn their hearts to their uncircumcised neighbors when God revealed they might be worthy of inclusion with the covenant people. Those who were not ready were still certain that such acceptance was blasphemy, even as God was providing a revelation of change. They had to move past the deeply held belief that an uncircumcised body meant God was not working sufficiently within that person, because for thousands of years, God had given the commandment through his prophets precisely because circumcision was the absolute sign of who was acceptable to God. Returning to the clients I have worked with in therapy, I often conclude that their difficulties occur not because they experience mental challenges as a result of their internal sense of gender or the love in their hearts for someone of the same sex, but because the hearts of people around them are hardened to see that love as authentic or their gender identity as authentic. Their fears of losing church and family come from the hardness of those around them. This is not to say that many of us, whether heterosexual, cisgender, or LGBTQ, don't have distorted thinking about love and relationships, or that we don't experience the consequences of trauma and relationship difficulties that affect how we see ourselves and our identities. But even when there is abundant mental and spiritual health in identities and same-sex relationships, we as members of the church are often not ready to see God in these people and their relationships. There may be purpose in understanding God as excluding people who seem to be the antithesis of our understanding of God. And on the other hand, there may also be purpose in our being ready to see something in these others as being more like God than we have heretofore understood. Thank you. Wow, I got through that faster than I thought I would. I'm sorry I went so fast now. But now we have lots of time for questions, which sometimes I don't allow. So please, I hope this has sparked something in you that you feel like you can share. It's all right with me. If you sit where you are, I'll repeat your question. It could be recorded. Yep. It would be ideal if you want to walk up there. But if you stand where you are and ask your question, I will repeat it for the recording, just so you know. Yes, Carolyn. Can I say that much? Can I put that on the recording here? Carol, this is beautiful. I would like to have it in your own words if you don't mind. We can, come converse with me right here and let me give you a hug.
Hello, my dear. Oh, now this is for the record, huh? I have for a long time been more comfortable with the notion that the history of everybody's religion is more a history of humanity searching for God, sometimes finding God, sometimes not finding God, and recording all of that, really, in their scriptures. Basically, as God told me this and God told me that, when in effect it was really, this is a jewel that time has determined was a godly thing, and this was not. So that view is more accessible to me, more comfortable to me, than the notion that God really truly did say, for this period of time, you know, circumcision is my will. And then God said, I think we are ready now to expand. And so God expanded. So, and I'm not entirely, I know there would be a variety of ways to look at that. And I'm not necessarily pressing you to say, do you think that God said, circumcision is my will, and then I think it's time to expand? Or maybe the people somehow decided that this was the good way to show their loyalty to God. And they, however they interacted with God, felt God's approval and then went on from there. It just makes more sense to me that a lot of the stuff is us searching for God, very often not finding God, and sometimes really finding God. And however you want to respond to that is fine or not.
It's beautiful, just like that. And if that sparked some thoughts in you, I hope you'll come share. That was beautiful.
Might trigger that need to approach God or to see this as a big enough issue or a concern that would send me to my knees and really seek God's will about it. And I'm thinking of Wilford Woodruff facing the disincorporation of the church and loss of temples and the threat to the temple work that he perceived that was enough to get him thinking about rethinking the gospel as they understood it at the time. And that's pretty darn big. And it was big enough to divide the church. If you make that change, you're going to leave some people behind. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to think, you know, is it the suicides that we're witnessing or the children that you're watching struggle and so forth that might be enough, or would it be the loss of membership, the data reports that they're getting, or
Well, if you're asking me personally, it is the LGBT people that I work with who grow up in the church and who have testimonies of the gospel, but who conclude there is no room for them. But I'm sure there are many revelations yet to come that hopefully we'll be prepared for. Thank you. Wendy.
So my question is, you've gone through all the different groups of people that throughout history the chosen people have discriminated against. So if and when the current church gets their head around the LGBT issue and we find a way to love and accept them, what group is next? Or is this the last one? Is this like the final group to full human equality? I mean, can you think of another group that...
Can you... Doubters?
Well, that's already happening.
Oh, it's so interesting. Once one is accepted, it seems like others come to the surface. But we can always hope that there's only one more than the second coming or something like that. Hard to know. Excellent question. Other questions? Comments? Heartfelt expressions? Yes.
I just wanted to, since we've got time, I wanted to add one to your list, to the exclusion, inclusion. So it goes very much along with what you were saying. As in the book of Deuteronomy, as the Israelites are about to enter the promised land, Moses gives a list of types of people who will not be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. And he explicitly says certain foreign countries, you mentioned some of them, and he explicitly says people who are broken in the stones, which was the current euphemism for eunuchs at the time. And in the book of Isaiah, the beginning of chapter 56, he said, Isaiah explicitly contradicts Moses of the book of Deuteronomy, saying anyone from these countries or any foreign people who want to accept my Sabbath to keep it and want to worship me are welcome, and explicitly that eunuchs, you're familiar with the beautiful Isaiah language. I will give unto them a name that is greater than of sons and of daughters. And their worship will be welcome in my temple. And what I said in my testimony meeting after the policy was, that's the way that prophets speak under the influence of the Holy Ghost.
If you find that reference quickly, would you... I'd love to have that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that beautiful thing. Yes.
I've enjoyed your presentation so far, let me say that. I do believe that God is the origin of change, not people. And if we look at ancient Israel, he made those folks crawl around in that desert until that whole generation had died off before he could get a generation he could do something with and bring them to a higher level. The experience I had relating to this was in 1960. I was in Johannesburg in the mission home, and we had one elder who was supposed to go home, and we received a telex from Salt Lake saying, keep him for 2 weeks, then his replacement will show up. When the replacement finally showed up, I asked him, I said, where have you been? We've been waiting for you for 2 weeks. He said, I've been in Nigeria. The people in Nigeria wanted to know about the church. They organized their own Mormon church and wrote to Salt Lake saying, send us information, help us. He said, I went there with a member of the church from headquarters. Church didn't know what to do. They thought this was a plea for welfare, and it wasn't. And he spent 2 weeks with them and then came down and fulfilled his mission in Africa with us. Wow. So my contention is God works on people and makes the change. It's not people that initiate the change.
Thanks for sharing that. The idea that Peter received a vision that was in some sense outside of himself would suggest that it was an external force and not simply inside himself, perhaps. And the detailed descriptions of what happened in the temple at the time that Spencer W. Kimball and the brethren prayed also suggest something near Pentecostal occurred, which suggests some sort of external something rather than just being from inside. Very interesting considerations. Pardon me?
I guess I kind of disagree with my husband because if you think the church speaks for God, I mean, I've been ahead of him on so many issues. It takes the church a long time to catch up with me.
You know, Lisa, I love these survey kind of things that, you know, with each progressive step, I think every one of us agrees that it's a good move, that, you know, God, if things are unfolding because of God or they're unfolding within us and so we're bigger, we're all liking the direction here. Occasionally, though, you get the fundamentalist pushback that's going to say, well, you're just giving into culture, you know, or something like that. 2 or 3 years ago, I responded to Denver Snuffer's paper here, and he basically said, the church is cutting down the tree of life to build bridges to, I can't remember, you know, the world or something like that. And yet, you know, for me, every one of the things that he said was, hold on here, this is a line we can't cross, was a good positive thing. So I guess that's a framing for is that how do we make this process of growing our hearts and expanding, especially when we play in religion, how does that become natural to people? Because we naturally, as we live, we change our stories about everything else all the time. We kind of grow into new understandings. You know, our parents were these could do no wrong authority figures. Pretty soon they become human beings with their own ups and downs. America was the greatest, and now we're all a little nervous about our exceptionalism and things like that. How is it that when it comes to religion, because it's that, these are the questions you got to get right, you know, kind of attitude. How do we make that more natural? Have you had clues in therapy or moving people beyond that might do it? Because it is a natural growth process.
Giving sense on talks. I don't know. That's a really good question. How have you been successful at that in your life? Expanding people's absolute certainties about what is salvific about religious doctrine.
To me, the implication of what you say is that perhaps the exclusion of the LGBT people will also be changed, and they will be included. Until that time, how do you counsel the people you see who feel an affinity to the church? And don't want to leave.
And if they have had spiritual experience as a young person, they are likely to have a deep affinity that either induces them to loathe themselves or to move away from participation. So that's a really important question. There are a number of pathways, and it seems like the very best therapy is to find out which pathway feels to the individual like their best mental health pathway, and that depends on a number of variables. One of the most beautiful parts of therapy is when a young person or an older person for whom a relationship with God has been damaged by a variety of things connected with this, to recreate a connection with God that is not influenced by the external forces, That is, that there's something directly to their hearts that says, you are acceptable as you are. And there is no outside judgment that can affect how I, God, feel about you. That changes things. That's the best therapy. But it's not in any therapy book I learned. Yes.
Maybe this is kind of more a comment, but something that's very much like the gays, a lot of stories that people tell are that they have gotten this spiritual witness, that they are accepted and loved by God. And I know that there were also a lot of black people receiving that same kind of witness before the change. And there, a lot were being prepared, as we know that there were some, a lot of people in Africa being totally prepared to join the church when that happened. And so we just have to start listening to the people involved, you know, how they're feeling. And if they're getting those, that should be something that maybe means something, you know.
As Peter says, if the Holy Ghost has already accepted them, what is holding us back? It is remarkable to me that people do receive that revelation without community support. That's an anomaly. There's very few of us that can maintain a course of action without support from family and community. I am guessing that many of you here want to be that kind of support in family and community for those who are not in the mainstream, and I, on behalf of all those who care, thank you. Thank you for what you do, and may you continue. Thank you.
So, before we leave, I feel like I need to say this, but 9 months and 10 days after my wife and I were married, we had a baby. And it wasn't too long after that that my wife announced to me that we were going to use birth control. Now, this was back in the days when the church frowned upon that. And I said, well, what about the brethren? And my wife said, let's put it this way. We're either going to use birth control or you're going to have to get used to taking cold showers. And I liked hot showers. And so guess who won out on that argument? I appreciate, Lisa, really appreciate what you've had to say. The inclusion has been wonderful. And in answer to Wendy's comment back there, I think the next group after the LGBTQ has got to be women. Thank you for coming.